far from being successful, too, as was in the English Channel and then in the Bay of Biscay for the period from June, July, and August 1944. And we were, the Germans wasted a lot of ammunition on us. We had the Junkers 88 fired a torpedo at us and missed. We had a couple of Dornier 214s firing glider bombs at us, which missed or slightly damaged one ship, and that's all. And I think they kept their distance because we had the silhouette of a fleet destroyer, which would have had a much more sophisticated anti-aircraft armament, and we could just really fire rather forlornly and go at high speed and zigzag and hope to get away with it was about all we could do. And we were many times fired at by shore batteries, very high caliber guns, but you know, you'd see the splash and you just get going and zigzag or make smoke, and they never seem to be able to get their sights on you again.
And the Normandy landings?
Yes, well, we were in the we were there for anti-submarine, but more importantly for anti-E-boat, for German motor torpedo boats attacks, and we had two brief actions with them. One of them in a dense fog where we couldn't even see them. We could hear their motors, and we fired at them by radar and drove them off. Another time in the middle of the night, we really hardly saw them at all, just got a sort of flash of their wake, and again fired at them and drove them off. The amazing thing about anybody would say, I think, about the initial few days or weeks of the Normandy landings was the intense shipping traffic on our side, and it was a miracle that there weren't more collisions. And not only that, there was an awful lot of floating hazards of bits of ships or wreckage floating about, which are a great hazard to navigation, which whenever we saw them, we tried to sink by our own gunfire just to get them out of the way, because you had these armadas of little landing craft bobbing about in the ocean, and they would have come a cropper if they'd run into a lot of these things. And there was a lot of bad weather in the English Channel, as you know, which was part of the surprise. The Germans simply didn't believe that the landings would be attempted in such foul weather.
And I remember it blew up nearly a gale about D plus 3.
Yeah, they postponed it for 24 hours, yeah. And then the weather was sort of moderately bad, and they said it was going to get worse. So Eisenhower made the big decision to go ahead, and which it was certainly been fully justified by events, and not forgetting he had about a million men sitting about in ships or in close proximity to landing craft waiting, and to have postponed the operation, I think, for more than a very few days would have been catastrophic in the disorganization it would have caused.
Yes, you can't unwind a thing like that. It's been building up for several years. Yeah. Tell me about the last days in Chaudière then.
Well, then the last days were, we did a lot of hard work. We were patrolling in the Irish Sea and the southwest approaches to the English Channel. Very difficult to distinguish between U-boats and wrecks on the bottom, and we tried to get silhouettes of what was on the bottom by using our echo sounder tracers and see if we could get anything that looked like a U-boat. And as far as we were concerned, there was a lot of hard work and rather unpleasant weather. And then we were redeployed to Iceland and ran into even worse weather. And we really achieved nothing much off Iceland. I suppose it was important to have the anti-submarine ships patrolling there, but we were in and out of the place quite a bit, and we lost one ship there, the Skeena.
Oh, yes.
I used to hate being at anchor. I would rather be either alongside, secured to a jetty, or out at sea. It was always hazardous in a destroyer in very strong winds to be at anchor, because you couldn't rely on your anchors holding. But I had the benefit of the previous winter in Scapa Flow, and I realized the shortcomings of our ground tackle at a destroyer, and And we would ordered him to go and, to anchor on Reykjavik roads, it was blowing so strongly that I didn't think our anchors would hold, but I chose a spot which was slightly more exposed, but gave me more room in case we did drag, and I put out the maximum amount of cable on one anchor, and eight shackles, and I put the other anchor, as they say, underfoot with two shackles. I kept the special sea duty-man closed up and stayed either on the bridge or in my bunk and my duffel coat with my binoculars round my neck, ready to jump. And as it happened, we held. We didn't budge. But the poor old Skeena, I don't think it experienced such conditions. They had half the amount of cable out on one anchor only. The captain went to his harbour cabin in the after part of the ship, and when they started dragging, it was too late for him to do anything about it.
And you had steam up, of course.
Oh, yes. We never didn't ring off the main engines.
Did you have to steam slowly when at the height of the gale, even though you had anchors down?
No, we were prepared to do that, but we didn't actually have to. And but the other, the Salon was there with Gus Belton. They were the closest ship to the Skeena. And when the Skeena started dragging, Belton sensibly did not try to go to their assistance, because if he had done anything, if he'd done like that, he would have ended up on the rocks as well.
Yes.
So the Skeena was a total loss, and they lost 15 men in the process. And so it was really a disgraceful example of this poor seamanship.
Well, I've often thought that. I've interviewed Peter Chance, and he didn't say much about it, and I didn't press him, naturally.
I was on the Board of Inquiry, so that's why I know something.
He was the navigator, he didn't want to anchor there because it's volcanic ash and not good holding ground. And I interviewed one chief petty officer who, there was almost, I gathered, near panic amongst the crew, and he was sort of an older man, and he quietened the crew down. But what he said was, quote, "There are no heroes in Skeena that night," unquote. And it seemed to me also that letting men try to get ashore in a Carly raft was
madness under those conditions.
Well, I think so. Yeah. And the way it was put by Peter Chance was, the captain said, "Well, if you want to try, go ahead." Yeah. Well, that doesn't seem...
It was a very shameful incident altogether. And the captain, Pat Russell, I brought him back to Derry on my ship, and he naturally figured he was for the high jump, but all he got, I think, was a reprimand or something. And as you know, you can't increase a charge given a verdict of a court martial. But in the returns of court martials, you know, the little report they used to put out at the courts martial during the course of the year, the Minister of Naval Service, Angus MacDonald, insisted on an entry on the Skeena court-martial that the penalty was totally unproportional to the severity of the charge.
The Board of Inquiry found that he'd been not taking sufficient caution?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to dwell on that, I don't think.
No, it was a very sad and regrettable occasion. One ship lost unnecessarily, really. But the weather abated in the course of the next 24 hours, and we eventually got alongside in Reykjavik Harbour, a little harbour there, and we had a terrific party. Then, of course, there was the funeral of the 15 men. Well, two of the bodies were never found, but the 13 were given a military funeral and organized by none other than Mr. Marjo, who was then become a lieutenant.
Oh, good.
And it was a very grim funeral because in Iceland there are no trees and therefore no wood for coffins, and the bodies were sort of bandaged onto stretchers like Egyptian mummies, and they have a permafrost, and so the grave is very shallow, and between the cold severe, gloomy weather, and the corpses bandaged onto stretchers in the shallow grave, I remember as a particularly depressing and grim occasion.
Dreadful.
But then there was a lighter side to it, was that Chummy Prentice, as the senior officer, by this time you could go on a boat and get aboard the Skeena and look around, and he decided that as a senior officer he should have all the captain's mess traps, particularly the fluted china, but I don't think he ever got them because somebody else had already swiped them, and it wasn't me.
Yes, I'm glad you remembered. Yes, real...
And then after that we did, I think, some one or two, yes, I think we did an operation down to Gibraltar and back, and eventually at the very end of 1944 they decided that our three ships, this time the Capel, the Kootenay and the Showdeer, were, you know, overdue for a refit and unfit for further service, and they sent us back to Halifax.
Did you ferry people back, because VE Day hadn't happened, eh?
No.
No. So you came back before VE
Yes,
Day?
Yes, the very end of 1944.
The end of 44. So mm-hmm. now we're moving into 45.
Yeah.
Because I know Bill Wilson, but up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence.
Yes, and he must. Our ship were just we spent a few weeks hanging about in Halifax, and then we were sent to Sydney, Cape Breton, for a refit, and I left the ship in about April 1945, I think she ever went to sea again. There was another captain, believe me, I think the war was so close to an end, they decided to just scrap the ship. I think that's what happened.
And she was scrapped?
Yeah. But I told you about being welcomed home in 1941 in the salon with the bands playing, and it was very different here after this. Most successful ships that had taken part in the tremendous operations of sinking U-boats. When we got to Halifax, our first order was to anchor in the harbour, because they didn't have a berth for us. And eventually, the next day or sometime, we were allowed to go in alongside the jetty. And then Admiral Murray came aboard. He evidently knew nothing of our exploits, because all he talked about was the conduct of men ashore, and saying that we were going to be required for local escort service, and it went over like a complete wet blanket as far as the men were concerned.
Gosh, you
however, I got them together and thanked them, and because obviously we were going to refit, and obviously the crews were all going to be dispersed in the usual way.
Bill Wilson told me about this. He said it was terrible, Admiral Murray's speech to returning warriors.
Yeah.
He said he just warned them that they better pull their socks up. They weren't in the UK now, and they wouldn't have any rowdiness ashore. He said it was quite an unsuitable speech.
Extraordinary thing, yeah.
Well, Admiral Murray is so revered, and maybe he's got his halo just because he was fired, but he doesn't seem to be very much on top of things.
No, I always felt he did his best work in establishing the base in St. John's, Newfoundland, and he did a great job there as Commodore of the Newfoundland Escort Force, and got that all established, and opened this new base in St. John's, and I think he did a great job then. But I think he had the kudos, of course, of being the only Canadian Commander in Chief, and as Commander in Chief North West Atlantic in Halifax. But the war wasn't there. The war was on the other side of the Atlantic, in the Eastern Atlantic, the Channel and Bay of Biscay and places, but that was the real, that was the vortex of the anti-submarine war was there. There were a few, the Germans took advantage of the fact to get some easy pickings, as we know, in the Gulf of St. Lawrence and all Halifax, but that was a lesser sideshow, and so poor old Admiral Murray, he never really had all that sort of exciting operational situation to deal with.
The other difficulty with our RCN senior officers were Jimmy Lamb, in his book The Corvette Navy, said it was a pity, it spoiled the book. He said the permanent force were all ashore. Well, of course they were all ashore. The RCN VRs might have known how to run a corvette, but they didn't know how to run a navy, and the permanent force officers of necessity went ashore. Now, this means that Rolla Mingy had some sea time early in the war. Yeah. Murray might have had.
Yeah. Murray had just a
touch. So our senior naval officers ashore, apart from Harry de Wolfe and a few other noticeable exceptions, Nelson Lay, never really had any wartime experience.
No, they were really too senior. But the only grave oversight I've already mentioned was not to have Canadian senior officers in Derry and to get them nearer to the scene of action and in command of the very actively engaged operational forces that we had at that time in the Eastern Atlantic.
China, must have had 30, 40, 50 ships.
Oh yes, predominantly Canadian. That was the male fist of the Canadian Navy. The operational spearhead was based in Derry and operating in the or Plymouth and operating in the Eastern Atlantic and or the mid ocean and the English Channel, Bay of Biscay and Russian convoys, all that sort of thing.
Yes.
And that, to my mind, was being wise after the event, was where we made a great mistake in not having Canadians command our operational forces.
Well, we had a senior naval officer in London, but it was Nellie's, for God's sakes.
Yes.
He had been to sea since 1936, and it was a figurehead job.
Well, that was a figurehead job. He was just a sort of liaison job. But what I mean is to exercise operational command of the forces, which we didn't.
No. A good point's been brought out. It's probably one of the highlights of this tape that we should have had. Of course, Mark Milner has spotted this long before you and I have been speaking about it today.
Sure,
we had no senior man over there. It's in his book.
Yes, it would have. Anybody studying the historical excerpts would come to a similar conclusion, I imagine.
Because that's the first analytical study we've had of our naval efforts.
Yes.
People have written their memoirs, which are just old men rambling. You know, Alan Easton had a good book. Mine wasn't bad. Jimmy Lamb had a good one. There were other ones, but they're not.
Lamb's. I've read yours, and I've read that was very good, and I read Easton's was good too. I don't know, but I didn't read Lamb's.
Well, I'll lend it to you. But there were no analytical studies until Mark Milner, and for that we have to thank Alec Douglas, who brought Mark Milner into the Directorate of History. I don't think you knew that, did you?
No, I didn't know that. Well, that was a good move. We were so closely wedded to the RM that there were some of our senior officers simply couldn't tell the difference between a Canadian sailor or a Canadian ship and a British one, and that was a big mistake historically and operationally as far as the conduct of the Canadian naval forces in World War II.
Good point. I'm going to go back for a minute before I forget it. You lived in Admiral's House, Victoria, as a boy.
Yes, that was my father was today he would have been called Commandant of the Naval College, but they simply used the naval terminology, and he was called Captain of the Naval College in the rank of Commander. And where do we want to go start from? We'll just talk about Esquimalt.
For a while there he was.
Yes, well, after the Halifax explosion, the college in Halifax was wrecked, and they decided to move everything to the west coast and establish themselves in a Esquimalt dockyard where they had suitable buildings. And this happened in 1918. And the naval cadets spent one term at the Royal Military College, Kingston, while things were being gotten ready for them in Esquimalt. And then mid-1918, they set up shop in the Esquimalt dockyard, and my father continued on in the same position as captain of the college. He was promoted commander in 1915, and for the last year of his service, from 1921 to 22, the Navy was cut back, and rather against his will, he wanted to concentrate his energies on the Naval College. They gave him the additional appointment of being a senior naval officer on the West Coast, and he had the resounding title Senior Naval Officer, Coast of British Columbia, and therefore we moved from our house in Sandwich to what is now Admiral's House, which had been the superintendent of naval stores residence in the Admiralty days, and so he was as it turned out, the first naval officer to live in the house, and that just went on for a year or so, and then the college was closed by political decision. My father was retired, and he died a very broken-hearted man 2 years later.
Broken-hearted why?
Because of the closure of the college.
Of the college, of
which
course.
Which was his sort of life work in creating it for 11 years, you see. And then, you know, thinking naturally it would go on indefinitely, and then they made this, wildly stupid decision to close it.
And your point was, if it had stayed in Halifax, it would never been allowed to close.
That's right. I think the local politics would have been sufficiently strong to have kept it going.
You know that array of pictures outside of Bob Yano's office of all his predecessors? Your father's picture should be in there, surely.
Yes, well, his name is on the brass plate as having resided in the house.
I must tell that to Bob.
Yes.
Get your father's picture.
Yes, he should be there.
It goes from the RN commanders-in-chief all the way up to the...
Well, my father was on the perch for about one, a little over a year, I think.
Well, we might change the sequence of pictures.
Yes, he should be there, certainly. And they have his picture, of course, in the Nixon block of Royal Road, Notre Collins. But the... As I wrote a little memoir about the my memories of as a little boy in Admiral's house, and it in the best British tradition, it had no central heating. It had a big stove in the hall, in the front hall, and then fireplaces all over the house. As I said, I remember there was one member of the household staff. He didn't wear a white coat as a steward, he seemed to wear just a sailor's regular uniform, and I presume he was a stoker, because his only function seemed to be to tend all the fireplaces and plus the hall stove, try and keep the place warm.
What else should we talk about now? We've come to the end of your war. Where did you go after?
After the war,
after your ship.
After the show here, I was appointed in command of the Crescent,
a
brand new destroyer, and she was under construction at John Brown's shipyard, Clydebank, outside Glasgow, Scotland, and there were great delays in her completion, and we were supposed to go out to join the war in the Pacific, but it was by the time we finally commissioned, it was about the time the war was over altogether, and so we never made it, and we did some trials locally and some workups in Portland and the south coast of England. And while we were in Portland, we had a nice little side trip. We were told to go and visit Jersey and Guernsey in the Channel Islands so that they could thank us for all the Canadian Red Cross supplies sent to them. And so we had a pleasant 24 hours in each place, and it was amusing, because if anybody's familiar with the Channel Islands, you know, it's a very fertile market garden with lots of good fruit and vegetables, and here we were supposed to commiserate with their hardships during the war, which they certainly had, because they were occupied by the Germans, but by the time we got there, things looked considerably more comfortable as far as food was concerned than in England itself, Anyway, the bailiff of Jersey, which is like the prime minister, they have a lieutenant governor, a figurehead, usually a retired general in this place, and then the fellow who runs the island is the bailiff, and this chap, Alexander Coutanche, was the bailiff of Jersey. And
excuse me, do you mind spelling it? Coutanche?
C-O-U-T. A-N-C-H-E. And he was the bailiff before the German occupation, during the German occupation, and after the German occupation. It seemed to me anywhere else he would have been strung up as a quisling or something, but he just bolted on right through, a charming man. He was eventually, I think, knighted or given a peerage or something, and he showed me round the place, I remember we went out into on a promontory of the island jutting out into the channel, and there was a church built in 1111, and he took me there, and he said it was nice and quiet, and he used to like to sit there to get away from it all sometimes.
Now, you brought Crescent back to Canada.
Yes, and we went through the Caribbean for a few days, and through the, and up to the west coast, and I remained in command for, I guess, until the end of 1946. Had the ship for about a year and a half, and we went up and down the coast. We went from Panama to the Aleutian Islands and spent a lot of time training cadets from Royal Roads. It was an interesting time because I wasn't familiar with those waters. Anybody who knows the inside passage of northwestern BC and Alaska, as it says in the naval pilot, the Mariner's Guide, it describes it as grand and striking scenery, which it certainly is in all those narrow channels up and down the coast. There we were.
And you turned over to Scruffy O'Brien.
Yes. And we went into a lot of these little ports, and here was the... And we were usually credited with having won the war single-handed in a brand-new ship that had never fired a shot at anybody.
Well... You could coast on that. You did your share of fighting. You had, to use an old-fashioned expression, you had a good war, Pat.
Yes.
Lots of excitement, lots of action, lots of successful actions.
Yes, it was.
And that's a good point you've raised, that we should dwell on our successes rather more.
Yes, I don't know why they don't. I think it's silly to dwell on what went wrong all the time when a lot of things went right.
Well, I think it's a good note on which to close. Anything else you can think of?
I don't think so, except for the pleasure of your good company as
well,
an old shipmate.
Well, it was very nice having these few hours with you. We took, in the middle of the tape, we had lunch at the Union Club. You met another old shipmate there,
Graham Bridgman. I'd been on the National Defence College with him.
There
we were.
So I'll see you in the next few days that you'll be here, and on behalf of Dr. Douglas, I thank you very much. He's got this screed, which...
Yes. I think he has that tucked away somewhere.
I think he's aware of it.
And that
September
covers some of what I said about the Chaudière.
Yes,
it's all about the Chaudière.
By the way, quickly, about naval papers. Have you any naval papers that the historian will be interested in?
Well, my father's papers I gave first to Alec Douglas, and then they ended up in the public archives.
Yes, that's where they should be.
And they were very pleased to have them. Because my father... all that time he was captain of the Naval College, his boss was Admiral Kingsmill, Sir Charles Kingsmill, in Ottawa, Director of the Naval Services, he was called, and they did most of their business by letter, sometimes in their own handwriting, and they did their business first. They talked about somebody relieving somebody else, or some improvements that were necessary for the college, and this and that, and then they usually wound up about some chat about the servant problem or the incredibly high price of sherry or something like that.
Dr. Douglas knows your address. Have you got any naval papers of your own at home that he might want? We've got a minute left.
I have some mementos. I've given you my memoir on the Chaudière called A River in September, which is also in the public archives, a copy of it. And I have an account that my father wrote of the Halifax explosion, and I've arranged to give that to Mac Lynch, who's the coordinating editor of Salty Nips, because he's trying to do a book on the early days of the Navy, and he said he'd be glad to have that, so I gave it to him. I've given him a copy. And I don't think I have anything of much consequence that hasn't already been
donated,
given to the right channels. We presented a lot of naval lore of my father's to the Maritime Museum here in Victoria.
Yeah.
So they've got that.
Well, that's good. We know what went before in your own words, and we know what's extant in the various museums and archives, and so again, thanks very much.
Well, a pleasure.
That's a good day's work.